let's move on then to employee benefits. John?
Thank you, Wayne. At this meeting, we are bringing proposals on measurement of plans for the project that we're working on employee benefit plans with a guaranteed return on contribution or notional contributions. And we are also bringing proposals on how to take this project forward if the committee agrees with our proposals on measurement. At the last meeting, the committee discussed the scope of the project and made a tentative decision on that. And at this meeting, we are bringing proposals on measurement. When the committee originally discussed this issue in 2005, the staff had brought forward four proposals on how to deal with the measurement of the plans. We think that after looking at this, these proposals, that we should rather focus on the two main issues we see as problematic, which are the discount rate used to present value the employee benefit, and the how to measure the higher off option in the plans that we're dealing with. As for the discount rate problem, what staff sees here is that the discount rate we are currently using when dealing with this plan is is the discount rate that is prescribed by IAS 19, which is the high quality corporate bond discount rate. However, due to the fact that these plans are the benefit that comes from these plans is very closely linked to the assets that and the return on the assets that are provided to fund these benefits, we see a problem there, because unless the benefit derived is exactly the same as the high quality bond, we get a mismatch in the liability. We either underestimate it or overestimate it. So we have come to the conclusion at this point that due to these close connections to the asset return, that it would be the simplest solution would be to use the asset, the expected return on the assets, to discount the employee benefit to arrive at the net liability. And therefore, in paragraph 28 of the paper, we are recommending that the discount rate used should be the expected return on the assets, which are provided to fund the benefit. And with that, I would ask the committee whether it agrees, or if not, how they would like to address this problem.
Scott?
In the example that's used up through paragraph 28, I disagree with the staff's proposal. As I understand this example, the employer has guaranteed a 4% return. The employer has chosen, but is not required to, fund that by putting assets into a fund that is expected to generate 4%. So the employer has apparently decided to invest in assets with a higher credit risk than high quality bonds. I don't think that should get the employer the right to use a higher discount rate. In the situation that you've described here, I would have thought that paragraph 17 is absolutely appropriate. The employer has guaranteed a return of 0.5% more than the high quality bond rate, so the employer has taken on an obligation. The fact that the employer thinks he's got assets generating 4% to fund it is all well and good, but I don't think that that should result in a and a lower discount rate, that the time when I think we ought to alter the discount rate to match the asset return is only if the plan says you are guaranteed whatever the return is on this kind of asset. In that case, absolutely, we need to make sure that we're discounting at the expected rate on the assets if we choose a model that involves discounting in that case. But in the situation described up through paragraph 28, I don't think we should alter the discount rate at all.
Ross and then Luca.
Yeah, some people made exactly the same comment to me when reading that paper as Scott, that they do see that there might be a liability here for the reasons explained by Scott. My comment would be, I don't know if you are working with Swiss companies, because I know that every Swiss company is affected by this issue you're looking at, so maybe it would be appropriate to work with Swiss companies on this issue because they have wide experience. Secondly, on this issue and also the other one on the higher up issue, I see that you are trying to help but the direction you have chosen is to introduce different principles from those which exist in IS 19 currently by going in different directions. And I'm a little bit nervous to go there, introducing new principles, new requirements compared to the whole body of IS 19 for a narrow scope project, where we know that currently IS 19 as it is a standard that look at projections and not at measurements at point in time, and so builds on projections and forward-looking. So I was wondering whether you have considered other solutions that already exist and we already use in IS 19 in terms of methodologies, mechanics in estimating, such as the ones we use for determining the asset ceiling under how we apply asset ceiling. That is, you project effectively your cases, making some assumptions. Effectively, you have to project the return on the asset you have, and you determine period by period whether or not the employer will have to make further contributions or further payments, will have to make further payments in addition to the contributions it makes. And then you discount that back, say, using the discount rate that is being used under IS 19. Have you considered this possibility?
No, we have not considered that possibility.
Luca and then John.
I have more or less the same consideration as Scott. In my opinion, the appropriate discount rate in this case is the one related to the high level of bonds, so in line with the IS 19. And this seems to me that is consistent with the fact that we are applying an actuarial evaluation like other plans that requires the employee to recognize the liabilities for the obligation assumed at a certain point with respect to the employee. In general, this is the first topic, but we have other topics that are around also EIS 19 and the appropriate discount rates to adopt it. I think that we should, if we have to look at this issue of discount rate, we should collect this in a more general sense in order to avoid a patchwork of different rules for different plans. And I would like to avoid to go to something like IFRS 2, in which there are a lot of rules for different elements, and more go to a more stable principle that we're able to cover different cases, but inside the same general principle terms.
John?
I mean, I see a fundamental difference between fixed return guarantees and guarantees on specified assets, so I don't know why they're all being sort of put together in the scope of items that get special treatment under this proposal. I also think that if we're going to look at reopening the discount rate in IAS 19, I mean, there's a whole lot of issues with the discount rate in IAS 19, so why would we open up that debate on a specific category or type of collection of arrangements rather than having a much more comprehensive discussion on the discount rate in 19 and what it's actually trying to represent?
Guido?
But I was convinced by the arguments in paragraph 16 and 17. So in this example, I wouldn't really understand why you would recognize a liability in the balance sheet. If you are guaranteeing 4%, you have provided for funds that are providing 4%, and then you're recognizing a liability. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I'm conscious of the problem that we have here, that obviously we would deviate from the measurement rules in IAS 19 as it is written right now. And I understand that that's why the staff's proposal is that we cannot deal with it, but it should be dealt with by the board. So they have to change the requirements in IAS 19. I'm not so convinced that there are other good solutions to that. So I would be in favor of going forward with this view. There is only one question that I have to the staff, to John, actually, is that I'm not sure whether what you are proposing in 28, paragraph 28, covers all the issues that should be within the scope, of these changes that you are looking at, and that you are describing in paragraph 4. So do you think all the issues that should be within the scope, all the plans that should be within the scope, are covered by your proposal in 28?
I would have thought they would. I mean, one of the definitions that we use here is that these plans, the plans that are covered by the scope, would be defined contribution plans if not for the guarantee that's provided. So, I mean, for defined contribution plans, there is a transfer of the contribution to the employee, so it's no longer the asset of the employer. So, but I think that basically this should cover the plans that we've described in the form.
Andrew.
I think I'm in the same place as Guido, actually. I assume the analysis up to paragraph 28 is talking about the unguaranteed benefit, just the unguaranteed benefit. Is that right?
You mean just the flow through?
Yeah.
Well, it was supposed to cover both, actually. Yeah.
What, including the higher of piece?
Well, I mean, for the higher of, what we are proposing, if we go to that, is that you just use the intrinsic value. You take the value that gets you higher and use that as the employee benefit. If the guaranteed amount is the higher amount, you use that. If the value of the asset is the higher amount, you use that.
Okay. Bernd?
I also agree with Guido and Andrew, because if I guarantee 4% and if I enter an investment that offers 4%, then I don't see why I should have an additional liability on that. However, I understand that BC 134 of IS 19, which is on the supplement that Michael distributed, if I read that correctly, it explicitly prohibits doing that. So we are, if we do that, although to me intuitively it's the right thing to do, I think we are in direct contradiction to IAS 19 BC 134. So we should solve this to some extent by either amending or whatever we can do about that.
Tricia?
I just wanted to wanted to ask the committee members that support the staff view of whether they're making a distinction between plans that have assets and plans that don't have assets, and whether they're making a distinction between plans where the guaranteed return is the return on the assets in the plan, as opposed to we guarantee the employee's going to get, we've credited them with 100 this period, and next period it'll grow to 104, and the period after that, 104 times whatever, with no assets in the plan, or whether you're thinking of a plan where the company's put 100 of assets in the plan when they guaranteed the employee, credited the employee 100, and the employee is guaranteed whatever is earned on that 100. Does whether the plan's funded or not and how it's funded matter to you?
I would expand on that. It does seem, and going back to Scott's original comment, I think there's a difference between an employer that says, promise you the return on assets of a particular type, and a plan that says, I promise you these assets.
But and the example isn't either one of them.
That's one of the difficulties.
The example is, I promise you 4%.
That's one of the difficulties. I think Patricia's comment was we've got too many balls in the air on this one.
Well, I did have circled on my copy here, what in the world does reflecting the risk of notional assets in in a plan where the guaranteed return is 4%? I don't understand what the notional assets are. If the plan says you are guaranteed the return on, the S&P 500, okay, then I understand what the risk of the notional assets are, but we've been working with an example where it just says you're guaranteed 4%.
Yeah. Okay.
This is Sandy. I don't know if you can hear me. I don't know how to jump in here.
Well, then jump in right now.
Can you hear me?
We didn't know you were on the line. Please go ahead, Sandy.
No, I've been here. I'm sorry. I guess my thought was similar to what Scott had said. As I read the entirety of this paper, and it may be my own bias, having been an insurance person, that I really looked at this as really these are guaranteed minimum account balances. And so I felt myself drawn to analogize to the insurance project if we're saying that IAS 19 doesn't give us guidance on this. And the first in the first item was on discount rate, because I'm not keeping up to the insurance project moment by moment. So I'm not certain exactly where it's at on this topic, but I didn't think that you used the return on assets unless, in fact, you had specific assets that you were had designated that you get a return on it. But I'm not up to the moment on that. So I guess I share a similar concern to what Scott had said.
I think that's correct, Sandy. That is where the insurance project is. You do not use asset rates to measure liabilities unless the liability is to deliver those assets.
Yeah.
Laurence?
Now, to respond to those who question why should you have a liability if you expect effectively that you won't have to pay further to cover further deficits because you expect having returns of 4%. I understand that, and so this is why I would really like to explore the approach as we currently do it in measuring an asset ceiling, whether you're going to recover assets or not, where you have to project how much return are you going to get and compared to what is the benefit, how much contributions would you have to make to cover for deficit or whether you're going to recover the asset. Here, so the calculation would be you have to estimate the returns you're going to have, and so you have to consider whether this is funded, not funded, or what is the basis for determining a difference with the promise you make. You project that forward. Obviously, you'll have to make estimates and assumptions, and you just do, you know, like the calculations we do under S19 currently. Why don't we go that route? And if effectively in your assumptions you have a bunch of assets where you expect a return of 4%, and you make a promise of a 4%, then you won't have further contributions to make, and so you won't have a liability. So this is why I'm proposing this route, which may work not only for the discount rate issue, but also for the higher RAV issue that we have not yet talked. And within the context of the standard to deal with this narrow scope issue.
I think the reason you're getting blank stares from the staff is just because we haven't thought about that approach, so we'd have to go away on it. Charlotte?
I really just wanted to agree with what Scott and Sandy had said. I think there's if you guaranteed somebody 4% and the market rate 3.5%, you'd expect to have an additional liability. I mean, you wouldn't be able to sell that liability at 1,000. And I think there's a fundamental difference between guaranteeing a fixed rate or guaranteeing a rate linked to assets. And then the question comes whether you've bought those assets or not. But I think they're two different issues.
Guido?
Just a quick answer to what Pat says. I agree with that. There is a difference, you know, what the guarantee really relates to, and whether you're funded or not, and whether you're acquiring assets that the guarantee is really tied to. So I agree with that. So if you're not funded, guarantee 4% and the high quality corporate bonds is 3.5%, then yeah, you have a liability anyway because it's not funded. The question is then how to measure the liability. I was actually referring to an example where you are guaranteeing 4%, you invest in a fund that has at least 4% return, and then in this situation, I think it doesn't make sense to show a liability.
But what if the fund does poorly in the future? The employer is on the hook.
Well, that's all about expectations about what you get in return from your planners. I mean, you could ever say, well, it might get worse. My expectations are above 4%, but what about if it's 1.5? Would you show a liability then?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's why the board said expected return on assets does not define discount rate. Discount rate is defined by high quality bonds, which we have an issue about that later. but it's not linked to the asset return. The only way I could see deviating from that is if the promise was actually linked to asset return.
Yeah.
But that's not what the example is. The example is 4%.
My understanding was it's tied to the assets, but it's at least 4%. Maybe I misunderstood.
Okay, well, maybe I misunderstood as well.
I don't know. The extreme example, I guess, would be, I had always read it as the higher of the percent was a minimum return, and the extreme example would be I go out and I invest in the S&P 500. And you're promised the higher of the S&P 500 or 4%. First problem is the S&P 500 doesn't have a discount rate.
That's right.
So you got to look someplace else to begin with, and then that seemed to me to walk you straight into the basis for conclusion.
Yeah, when you tie the promise to assets, I understand measuring it based on the assets, but for the piece of the promise that is 4% return on contributions, I can't see tying that discount rate to the assets.
So Bert?
We're in the same place. Okay.
To my understanding, it's a matter of who bears the risk of the underlying asset, right? If I guarantee 100 plus 4% without underlying an asset, so if I'm not guaranteeing this particular asset and it's a corporate bond and the corporate goes bankrupt, then I still have to pay 100 plus 4%, even though I tied it somewhat in my books to the 100, to the corporate bond. If I tell the employee, you get this particular bond, then he bears the risk.
Yeah.
So that, so I
that would also be defined contribution, so we wouldn't be having this argument. Okay, I think I'm going to call for a show of hands. As a matter of general principle, and I think we have to spend, the staff has to spend some time laying out specific plan designs and how to operationalize different plan designs. Who would favor amending on some sort of scope 19 to allow an asset-based rate? 19 to allow an asset-based rate, and we're, obviously we've got problems around scope, but as a general principle, who would favor that?
When the promise is tied in return on assets?
Well, that's the difficulty. If the promise is, if the promise is tied to the return on specific assets, then it's a defined contribution plan.
Not if there's a minimum guarantee.
That I was about to say. But the addition of a minimum guarantee makes it a defined benefit plan. So I think we have to say, in the presence of something that makes it a defined benefit plan. Okay.
One more example. I think even if you tie it to the return on specific assets or an asset class, if you don't make contributions, it's still a defined benefit plan, is it
yep.
not? If you only have notional assets?
Yeah, for it to be defined contribution, you got to make a contribution.
Right, so I don't think you need the minimum guarantee necessarily
to
be in the scope.
Point taken. Let me drop back 10 then. I think then before we can have a discussion about the discount rate, we have to have a more clear articulation of the different plans to which it would apply. I hear a majority who have significant reservations about amending 19 on discount rates, and I share those reservations. Having fought this battle all the way back to FAS 87. But let's bring back, Jan, a specific description of the various types of plans, and if it's 6 or 8 or 9 that you need to describe, do it, to which you think something like this should apply so that then the committee can look at it and say, no, I don't like it for 1 through 7, but I'm happy with 8 or something like that. Does that sound to like a reasonable approach to everybody? Okay, that's what we'll do. Thank you. Oh, we still have the higher up.
The next issue on measurement that we consider has to be addressed within this project is the measurement of the higher off option, which currently the IS 19 does not deal with. And what we're proposing here is to use the intrinsic value, that is, that you would only take the option that gets you the higher benefit and use that, ignoring all other options. So we think that that is consistent with the best estimate approach that's used in IS 19. And we also believe that that is the simplest way to we can do that. We acknowledge that we may be ignoring the time value of money by not fair valuing the option. But in our opinion, that it is justifiable to use the just the intrinsic value at the reporting date. And with that, I'd like to give that over to the committee and ask it whether it agrees with the staff recommendation or not, and if not, how that would like to address the option.
Scott?
This one, I think I agree with the staff. Although I take the point of those who think that we ought to try to measure the fair value of the higher of option,
I don't, this sounds ridiculous, but I don't think their value mixes well with IAS 19. That might suggest we need to work on IAS 19, but we leave that for another day. And you know, here I think that if we have, you know, higher of the value of these assets or a 2% return on contributions, I think we measure the 2% guarantee on whatever basis we decide to measure it on. And then if the assets are worth more than that, then I'd just recognize the intrinsic value as you proposed.
Laurence, and then Luca.
Yeah, similarly to the concerns I expressed, getting away from the IAS 19 logic, which is projection-based. Here you propose a point-in-time measurement, so which is not the logic in IAS 19. I would like you to explore further how we could go for projection-based measurement. I'm not saying I support a fair value. I'm not going into the root of fair value, but some type of projection-based measurement. If what would it be so much more difficult so as to remain consistent with the logic of IAS 19?
Scott, do you want to come back on that, and then Luca?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of skipped this in saying that I agreed with the staff, but, you know, my thinking is actually trying to apply the projection-based logic of IAS 19, but when you're dealing with the higher-of promise that is tied to specific assets, well, there I would project it forward at the expected rate of return on assets and project it back at the same rate, because that is the discount rate that's inherent in the promise. So that's why I would get back to the intrinsic value of the assets.
Luca?
I agree with the staff recommendation. I think that even though in general fair value measurements will necessarily take into account the time value of the option, in this case we are speaking something that have to be included in the definition of fine benefits, so according to rules and the guidelines of EIS 19 that are not necessarily similar to those of EIS 39. The other element is that this is an option that's it's a little bit better. It's not a freestanding derivative, so the employer cannot be, this option cannot be sold, cannot be monetized in any case, so probably this could help also to conclude that the intrinsic value is a supportable value for this kind of elements to be evaluated.
Just an observation before I had another flash. An observation or a question hadn't occurred to me until I was listening to the discussion. When does this option reset? In other words, guarantee option, whatever. It's one thing for the employer to say, I promise that when you retire, the cumulative return will have been 4% compounded. That's one promise. The other is, and the insurance companies have experienced this problem, I promise you every year that you are guaranteed 4% on last year's balance. So that's an index that resets every year.
It's not compounded in the same way.
Well, in other words, if you earned 8 this year, you'd get a guarantee of 1.04 times 1.08.
The compounding is on whatever.
Right.
Actual was last year.
And I don't know, and maybe it would be worth asking some actuaries, how these things reset, because that too might affect your thinking about both the discount rate and the guarantee, I think. Bernd?
Yeah, I I agree with the staff recommendation, because to me, there's no conceptual difference between a minimum return of 4% or 4% or a higher option, because, I mean, you always take, if you have a minimum return of 4%, which we had in the previous discussion, of course you take the higher option if you earn more as employee. So where's the conceptual difference to this particular example of the higher option? So I don't see why we should value the option differently, because there's an option in the minimum case as well. Implicitly, you always have the option of it could be more than 4%. So I see this as particular case of the other cases we had before. So I don't see why we should value the option differently.
Sandy, did you want to come in on this one?
Yeah, I did. Sorry, I struggled to jump in here. I don't want to interrupt anyone, and I can't see the queue. But I guess.
Well, Michael and I will try and remember to call on you.
Yeah, I guess I look at this and I say, the reason we're taking up this issue is because we're saying IS 19 doesn't address the issue. And to me, I look at this, and I admittedly I'm biased by having been an insurance person, but I say, all this is a guarantee.
Yeah. Sandy, can you speak a little louder? We're having trouble hearing you.
Oh, sorry. Let me take it off the speakerphone. Is that better?
Oh, that's much better.
Okay. I guess I'll start again. I guess I look at this and say we're taking up this issue because IS 19 doesn't address the issue. And I look at this and say to myself as I read this, all this product is a guaranteed minimum account balance. And we seem to be who I pay it to, i.e. an employee versus a customer, seems to be driving a different answer than maybe, well, I guess I can't see what the answer would necessarily be under the proposed new insurance standard. So I feel myself drawn to know how I would come up with a different answer, or how would the answers be different. I guess that's my first comment. And my second comment is wanted to draw on something that Andrew said at the outset, which was, does the discount rate apply to the higher of option? Because if you're doing, and maybe I'm mistaking what he said or what he was alluding to, but we're saying that this intrinsic value doesn't include time value, but if we've calculated one of the balances including the discount rate, doesn't it inherently include some discounting, which would be the difference between the intrinsic value and time value? I mean, not perfectly, but to some degree. And I guess my final comment is on the higher of option, are we assuming that in all of these plans there are assets, specific assets identified? So it's different than the first scenario where there may not have been assets?
I mean, for plans with no general assets, of course we don't have the higher of option there, because then you just have the guaranteed amount.
Yeah, I think we've been sloppy in our use of language. I think when Jan was referring to time value, he was talking about the time value of the option, which would be the volatility and all of that, not to time value as in discounting, because the intrinsic value obviously is a present value. So I think we've been a little imprecise in the language, and that may be confusing us some. Scott?
I was just going to respond to Jan's comment. I think even if the assets are notional, you could have a higher of option, because you could have notional assets of 1,000 and you promise the person the greater of 4% or the return on the S&P 500 on the notional contribution of 1,000.
Yeah. You could have reference assets, right?
I think so.
Do Okay, I'm seeing general support for the notion of using the intrinsic value for this one. I don't seen some people who'd like to do fair value, but 1910 pushes you more to intrinsic value. I neglected to say when I was summarizing the last section that I do think we need to pursue Lawrence's idea of whether or not the asset ceiling is a productive line for us to follow. I've always struggled to even understand how that one worked, so that's a little bit the response about why my blank stare. Anybody else on this one? Andrew?
Well, it wasn't on the recognition presentation point. Are we going on to that? Because maybe we don't need to go into that, but it seemed to say that everything to do with the higher of option went through OCI as a remeasurement. I wasn't quite sure why that would be the case. Shouldn't there be some allocation to P&L through interest cost? No.
Well, if we then move on to the to that point, I mean, the staff recommendation was that all changes in the higher of option would be recognized in OCI, and we believe that, well, the difference between the difference in the option is basically the asset of the employee, not the company, and should not affect the P&L of the employer.
So you don't regard that as part of the benefit promise when you do?
Well, I mean, the difference would basically be that the assets are worth more than the guaranteed amount.
Right. But it's still part of the promise you're giving the employee, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, that was what we are asking the committee to comment on, whether they agreed with that or not.
Thank you for reminding me there was more left of the paper.
There's still another.
Scott?
Yeah, I wasn't comfortable with this recommendation. What if the promise is the higher of a return of negative 30% or the return on the assets? You could do that. So now are we saying basically the entire return winds up going through OCI? Or what if you have a plan that has notional contributions that are just tied to the S&P 500? It's not a higher of, but it is measuring the defined benefit based on the value of the reference assets. Is that all going to go through OCI as well? I didn't feel like I could answer a lot of questions with this, so I wasn't sure I was comfortable with the suggestion.
Well, I really hadn't thought about the negative return of 30%.
Or you could just guarantee a zero return. I mean, I don't think anybody's really going to write a plan that substantively guarantees, you know, you won't lose more than X. But I've certainly seen plans that have, you know, a guaranteed floor of you get back whatever you put in. So that's a return of zero.
So what kind of profit and loss element would we have then?
Well, I don't know. I didn't have a way to measure it, but it seemed to me that if you had a plan, you know, where it was, you know, you get the return on these assets, but we promise you won't lose money, so that's a guaranteed return of zero. Wasn't sure I was comfortable with all of the return above zero going to OCI.
I think this one folds nicely in with the way we're going to approach the discount rate. Let's look at the different plan designs and look at what the implications would be for classification presentation.
Then it's the final question for the committee, which relates to how we would proceed with this issue. I mean, it may not be relevant in light of the discussions that we have, so we should probably just bring that to another meeting.
Obviously, we've taken a different path on this one. Staff have sufficient guidance?
Yep.
Okay.
Samples.
Mr. Capsis.